As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Everyone reading Howard Marks leans forward and reads a little more carefully. He is successful. He is a philanthropist. And Lisa Abramowitz, we know for certain, is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Met Gala is Howard Marks' fault.
Yes, well, we actually very much appreciate it for us who have spent many, many hours at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There also is this question of investor psychology, and Howard Marks is co-chair and co-founder of Oaktree Capital, and frankly, one of the co-founders of the entire distressed debt market really understands how psychology can drive what is perhaps the best philosophy going forward, and he writes these fabulous memos from time to time, his latest Bull Market Rhymes. Howard, thank you so much for being with us. I want to start with trying to understand investor psychology. And as a student of history, where are we right now in terms of bullish or bearish?
I think that attitudes were quite bullish prior to a few months ago, with the exception of a brief respite during the pandemic. We've been in a bullish climate since the end of the global financial crisis in 2009. Not wildly bullish, certainly not what I would call euphoria, but optimistic. And that has been crimped now. A lot of the big name stocks are off 50, 70, 80%. The whole market is off, probably 15% from the high. So I would say that attitudes are more balanced today, when there's euphoria, when there's optimism, when there's greed, when there's risk tolerance and so forth, that's a very difficult climate for the value investor to find bargains. So we're happier today than we were 6 months ago. I don't know if we're going to be happier 6 months from now. That is to say that the bargains will be more pronounced. But at least, as they say, the bloom is off the rose.
At a time of such incredible uncertainty, how do you position seeing value now, but also preparing for seeing more value in 6 months?
One of the six tenets of Oaktree's investment philosophy, which we established when we started in April of 95, and I've never changed a word, and I believe in thoroughly, is that we're not market timers. And that means mostly two things. We never sell to raise cash to prepare for a decline. And we never say it's cheap today, but it'll be cheaper in 6 months, so we'll wait. If it's cheap today, we buy it. If it's cheaper in 6 months more, we buy more. And I think that that works much better than an assertion that we know where the market will be in 6 months.
This is really important at a time when so many pensions and institutional investors have been shooting for that 7.5% to 8% bogey. We talked about that extensively in the past 5 to 6 years. This idea that that seemed completely unachievable in an era of quantitative easing. Suddenly, high-yield bonds have an average yield of more than 7%. Is this the best period that you have seen for pensions to actually hit their bogeys for more than a decade?
I think that's right. Of course, many have hit their bogeys. It just didn't look in advance like they would. But the stock market and many other things have surprised on the upside for the last 10 years. But now, as you point out, one of our big activities is high yield bonds. And a year ago, they were yielding in the threes of percent. One deal was even done in the twos. That's not a very high yield for high yield. Today, as you say, they yield in the sevens. So a pension fund that needs seven or seven and a half can make use of high yield bonds. And everything, you know, see, when everybody gets concerned when prices decline. But if you flip that over, the flip side of price deterioration is increases in prospective returns. So now the prospective returns are on many asset classes are higher than they were just a little while ago. And again, a much better climate for the bargain hunter.
Some people would counter this by saying inflation takes a lot of the value out of those returns, that basically on a real basis, you're still not getting very much. How do you counter that as a long-term investor by saying, you know what, at this point, it's worth it to get higher returns, even if on a real basis, it's not necessarily that much more?
Well, you're right in that we're not talking about an increase in real returns. We're talking about an increase in nominal returns. Most pension funds and other organizations reckon their need for return in nominal terms. That is a challenge. Nobody knows what inflation is going to do. I think I heard out of one ear your previous guest say that, some of the inflation factors will probably subside in the next few months, which means, all things being equal, an increase in real returns.
How much are you trying to game out where inflation is going to go over the next 6 to 12 months, considering the fact that I know that you do not time the market or look at a sort of day-to-day price swing kind of issue, but this really does determine how important some of these returns will be going forward?
Yes, it does, but I don't think there's anything to be known on that subject, and I'm sure we don't know it. And another tenet of our investment philosophy, there are only six, we're going to touch on two today, is that our investment decisions are not based on macro forecasts. Macro forecasts are very important. The only problem is they're rarely right. And more importantly, any one forecaster is rarely right more often than the others. So we don't make our decisions on that basis. We are what's called bottom-up investors. We invest on the basis of micro, not macro, companies, industries, securities, and we feel there, through hard work and skill, we can get an edge.
So where are some of the industries, some of the areas that you're actually seeing deep value?
They are much more spread around than they were before. Some growth names are offering much better value than they did a year or two ago, down 70%. But, we continue to find opportunities throughout the investment universe. The prosaic industries are also offering good value.
When you talk about the global investment picture, I know over the years, especially as the U.S. yielded less and less and yet less in real terms and in nominal terms, you looked overseas, in particular to China,
yes,
as a potential area of prospective return. Has that changed as yields have gone up in the U.S. and, frankly, the economy has slowed so substantially in China?
Well, on the one hand, we have a preference for investing in the U.S. The U.S., in most regards, has the best economy in the world, and it has an excellent environment for rule of law, for being able to predict the outcome when various stakeholders' rights come into conflict. That's very important to us, especially you mentioned our business in distressed debt investing. That's very important if you're going to buy distressed credits to be able to predict how we'll be treated by the law. On the other hand, from time to time, other parts of the world offer better bargains. We have the best in the U.S., but the best usually doesn't come cheap. So, and third, on the third hand, we like to have some diversity in our portfolio. So, we've been investing in places like China and India in the last couple of years, and absolutely will continue to do so. When I hear people say, I've made my living for the last 50 years investing in the things other people said were uninvestable, high-yield bonds, distressed debt, emerging markets in 98, et cetera. And when I hear people say that China's uninvestable, to me, uninvestable says maybe there are some bargains there if everybody else is boycotting that sector.
How fully invested are you? Are you always fully invested?
We strive to be fully invested. Again, we're not market timers. Market timers say, well, right now we want 20% cash. We strive to be fully invested. Our clients hire us to invest in our asset class, not to time the market. And again, if better bargains arise, I'm always confident that we'll be able to raise more money to take advantage.
About 3 years ago, when we were talking about what prospective returns seemed plausible or realistic on some sort of safe or reliable basis, you said 5 to 5.5%.
You have a good memory.
Where are we now?
I think we can make 7 to 7.5. I'm saying an institutional portfolio. At that time, I was talking for the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I chaired the investment committee, and I talked the expectation down to 5, 5.5, as you say. I think the committee as a whole came out at 6. Today, I think an institution like the Met or another pension fund, endowment, et cetera, can make 7, 7.5. Of course, you have to be willing to go into alternatives to do it, but most people are willing.
What kind of alternatives?
You know, the big classes are private equity, private debt. Then there's distressed debt, there's real estate, and specialized forms of investing. The important thing is not which sectors, the important thing is which manager. You know, in the public asset classes like stocks and bonds, we call them beta markets because most of the return is determined by the performance of the market, and which manager you have means a little plus or a little minus. In the alternative markets, there isn't that gravitational pull toward the market return. There's no really market to pace it. What really matters is whether your manager is highly skilled and disciplined or not. And that's why we call them alpha markets, skill markets.
Do you think that your peers are taking undue risk or not enough risk?
Some of each, of course. There's a disparity. You know, there's a range, and all peers do different things. The point is, an area like private lending, where we're very active, has been a darling in the past decade. A lot of money and a lot of managers and a lot of funds have moved into the area. Buffett always puts it best. When the tide goes out, we find out who was swimming without a bathing suit. When economic and financial conditions become more difficult, we find out who made good credit decisions and who made bad ones. We'll see.
What's the historical precedent for this moment?
For this moment? Oh, you know, it's very hard to find one that fits exactly. You know, we've never had this externality of the pandemic. There hasn't been a war going on in a long time, an important international conflict with the threats this embodies. The U.S. never had an economic rival like China before. We never really had an economic rival since World War II. And of course, we have historically low interest rates. We had interest rates went down by what we call 2,000 basis points. That is to say, 20 percentage points from 82 to 22, and that was a big tailwind. So these conditions are not reminiscent of any that I've lived through. But I think the important thing for your purposes and hopefully your audience's purposes is that I think that our taken as a whole, I think conditions are fairly normal today in terms of how you should manage your money and the risks you should take. And to me, that's the key decision.
Howard, thank you so much for taking the time. Howard Marks, the co-chair and co-founder of Oaktree Capital.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Bill Dudley, the former New York Fed president, out with this morning. Tom, here's the headline of his new column. The Fed's mild inflation forecasts need explaining.
They do. They need explaining. It is a brilliant note. I'll have it out on Twitter. I'm sure John and Lisa will as well. William Dudley is the former president of the New York Fed and, of course, writing for Bloomberg. We're thrilled that Bill Dudley could join us this morning. Bill, buried in your essay on inflation is a single sentence on what it means for the labor market. April of 2020, a 14.7% unemployment rate. We're at 4% at the beginning of this year. We're now down to 3.6%. I need you to explain to our listeners and viewers why it's the Fed's job to move the unemployment rate, as you state, up above 4%.
Well, the labor market is the tightest basically it's ever been, and you can see that by the ratio of unfilled jobs relative to the number of people that are unemployed. That ratio is 1.9 to 1. In February 2020, it was 1.2 to 1. So we have a labor market that's unprecedentedly tight. The Fed needs to loosen that up, or wage pressures will accumulate, and that will keep inflation above the Fed's 2% inflation objective. The problem the Fed has is that in the past, it's been very, very difficult to push the unemployment rate up meaningfully without precipitating a hard landing. That's what the Fed's going to try to do this time, but extremely difficult to do. And they haven't really been as forthcoming, I think, in their forecasts as they need to be, because if you look at their last summary of economic projections, for example, the disinflation occurred almost immaculately. The Fed didn't really tighten very much. The unemployment rate didn't rise. Yet inflation came back to the Fed's 2% target. And it really begged the question of what caused inflation to come down. I think the way you get inflation down is you need more slack in the U.S. labor market. That's not a friendly message from the Fed, but that's what's necessary at this point.
And Bill, just to put some numbers on that, as you say, core PCE year end for the Fed, 22, 4.1%, 23, 2.6, and unemployment 3.5, and then 3.5 again. And many people have been asking the same question. Bill, you know the chatter right now. It's this conversation about a pause in September. How are you interpreting some of that conversation?
I wouldn't put too much stock on it. I think what's happening is the Fed's pretty convinced that they need to go to something close to neutral, and you know, expeditiously is the way that they put it. And so that's what they're doing. The notion that at some point they're going to take a pause and look around, of course that's going to happen at some point, but it's going to be driven by the economic data. I think that the economy is going to have enough momentum to keep the Fed will keep going into the fall. The market's priced to a peak in the federal funds rate of 3%. I think we're going to get to there pretty easily, and the Fed will probably actually have to push beyond that ultimately.
Bill, what kind of unemployment rate are you looking for to indicate perhaps a tightening, a loosening in the very, very tight labor market?
Well, the Fed's own forecast is that a neutral unemployment rate consistent with 2% inflation is 4%. So I think you need to get the unemployment rate up to at least 4%. The fact that we have so many unfilled jobs suggests that maybe the unemployment rate consistent with 2% inflation is even higher than 4%. So I think we need to at least get to 4%. And that's the problem. It's difficult to do that without precipitating a full-blown recession.
Bill, did you take any message from the fact that President Biden met with Fed Chair Jay Powell yesterday, that there was this focus on the Fed being the main driver for what happens with inflation going forward and the politicization of the Federal Reserve?
Well, I think Biden was actually not politicizing the Fed. He was basically saying the Fed's job is to control inflation, and I'm not going to challenge the independence of the Fed to do that. In some ways, though, he's putting the burden now on the Federal Reserve rather than on the administration. I viewed it as a political event, not an economic event. I don't think it changes what the Federal Reserve is going to do or what the Biden administration is going to do.
Bill, we had a one-off medical event, a pandemic of our lifetime. That got us out to 14.7% unemployment. Can we cut any central bank slack and have them extend out the x-axis and just take longer to get this done to repair off of this medical event?
Well, if they take longer, the risk will be that inflation will stay higher, and then that will start to get embedded in higher inflation expectations, which will make their job more difficult. The good news for the Fed right now is they're highly credible. Market participants expect the Fed will do the job and get inflation back down. Inflation expectations at the longer term horizons are still very well anchored. If the Fed dawdles, then the risk is that inflation expectations become less well anchored, which will make it harder for the Fed to get inflation back down.
Bill, is your view hardening, not softening, based on incoming data that this Fed funds might end up with a four handle and maybe not a three?
I don't think it's changed too much. I mean, the good news is that the Fed has things in hand today in terms of market confidence, in terms of inflation expectations being well anchored. That's the good news. The bad news is I think people are understating how difficult this job is.
What do you make of this idea that they can target job openings, Bill? JOLTS data, which is a little bit dated. What do you make of that?
Well, I think their story is a quite an optimistic one, that they can tighten monetary policy sufficiently to reduce the demand for labor without actually pushing up the unemployment rate meaningfully. This is the tightest labor market I think we've ever had, frankly. And it seems to me if labor market is tighter than it's ever been before, that makes the job more difficult, not easier.
Super hard. Bill, wonderful to catch up. Bill Dudley there, the former New York Fed president on the path forward, and a really interesting piece on the Fed's inflation forecast available on Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal on the Bloomberg Opinion column. Here's a note from our next guest, Tom. Back in April, we lampooned a Washington Post opinion writer for their obtuse observation that if it were not for that darn inflation, Biden's economy would be extraordinary. The writer went on to say that Rubin's logic was as intellectually robust as us saying that if our grandmother had wheels, she would be a bus.
That can only be the wonderful Stephen Schork, founder and president of the Schork Group, John. His note, folks, is just the breath of fresh air within the petroleum business. Is Ed Morris of Citigroup, who we just listened to, talks about the macroeconomics of the moment. Stephen Schork is hyper-defined. Steve, let me go to the single sentence of your note. 99% of us are simply getting poorer in this commodity surge. Will that trend continue?
Absolutely, Tom. So real disposable income, what we have to spend, has fallen in 10 of the past 13 months because of runaway inflation. Inflation, by the way, that all the smartest people in the world spent the better part of last year doing yeoman's work, making fools of themselves every single week, saying that, oh, inflation is transitory. Yes, if I don't have to eat, if I don't have to put the lights on, if I don't want it to stay cool this summer, yes, right. Inflation. Not a problem. But what we're seeing now, Tom, it always comes down to commodities. And what we're looking at in the energy industry, well, we know that story. But what most people, especially the ESG crowd or the people that are taking the war against natural gas, is the war on natural gas is a war on the American consumer. So what it has done to fertilizer prices, of course, natural gas is a key feedstock into synthetic ammonia fertilizer. So we're putting fewer seeds into the ground this spring, which means we're going to take fewer crops out of the ground in the fall. So the inflation has not peaked.
Right.
I mean, peaked on the core level. But as far as energy and food, which is all dangerous, all inflation has
right.
not peaked. And Tom, this is the problem. Runaway inflation at the gas pump and at the grocery counter has been the lead indicator for recession of the last six recessions in the United States, beginning with the
Okay, Steve, I want to go to the hyper detail of your note and your true expertise on distillates. Do you have any optimism we're going to invest given these higher prices?
Well, as Winston Churchill once said about America, we always make the right decision after we've tried every other decision. So I'm not quite sure we're there yet. Here on the East Coast, of course, what has happened? Well, over the past 3 years, we've cut our refinery capacity by 40%. So now gasoline production on the East Coast has held steady. But when you cut your capacity to make things out of crude oil, something has to give. So while we've maintained the status quo on gasoline production, diesel production has fallen 40%. So right now, diesel stocks for the first time ever are in the East Coast are below 9 million barrels. So we are looking at a dire situation in the diesel market, but we're not quite there. The smartest thing the Biden administration can do with regard to the energy crisis here in the United States is rescind the Jones Act. The Jones Act requires all interstate commerce, waterborne, be tagged on American flagged vessels. Well, guess what? We don't have enough American flagged vessels. You need to rescind the Jones Act, allow diesel, gasoline being manufactured in Houston to put that on foreign flagged vessels to bring it around the tip of Florida and get it into the East Coast. That is the smartest thing to invest in a short-term fix.
Yeah.
Regard to the longer-term fix, no, there is not a political will at this point to invest in fossil fuels. Thereby, the long-term structural imbalance between supply and demand will remain. High prices, therefore, have to remain, Tom.
Stephen, have you been surprised by how little pushback there has been on consumers with respect to reducing spending? There has been a reduction in real spending, if you look generally at the trend. However, overall, they continue to spend more, even as you see new records every day of gas prices.
Yeah, absolutely, Lisa. Now, the calculus there has changed because we have substitutes in the market, i.e. EVs. So it used to be consumer spending would drop off and gasoline prices, national average, hit about $3.60, $3.80. Gasoline on the NYMEX now is trading over $4 a gallon. So the AAA average right now is about $4.60 national average. Given where futures are trading now, by the 4th of July, gasoline prices will be another 20 cents higher, $4.80. I do have to believe, even though we've never had anything to mark this against, we will start to see that. But to your point, yes, that it has been one of the positives. Consumer spending the last week came out last week, stronger than expected. But the problem there is that we're waiting for the other shoe to drop because the personal savings rate plunged to 4.4%. We are well below the 30-year non-recession mean on savings and the 60-year non-recession mean on savings. In fact, savings rate is now at the lowest point since 2013. So the bottom line, Lisa, is we've run out of all the stimulus money. Americans are dipping into their piggy banks. It costs more to drive to your picnics, to go to the beach, so forth. So in the next quarter, yes, I do expect to see consumer spending to tail off, which of course is a problem, given that consumer spending is two-thirds of the U.S. economy. And this is why I'm still comfortable in saying, if the United States is not currently in recession, given these food costs, energy costs are falling income, we will be in a recession within the next 6 months.
Stephen, usually I say thank you, but that one was a little bit depressing. Stephen, thank you, though. Anyway, Stephen Schork there of the Schork Group. Thank you, buddy.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is not a small matter. Lean forward and listen, Global Wall Street. There's a guy up in Connecticut, runs a small shop, who says cash is trash. Deborah Cunningham joined Federated when she was 12 years old. She's been doing this forever. She is the absolute dean of global liquidity markets and CIO at Federated Hermes, CFA Pittsburgh, and the rest of it as well. And Deborah, you go after Mr. Dalio and you say cash is an asset. Discuss why cash is not trash.
Well, first of all, I want to know how I can get in on the trip to Vienna.
Very
please
good.
Include me in those emails.
We will.
As far as the cash markets at this point, as you mentioned earlier, We have been in a zero yield environment for the better part of 14 years now at this point in time. It's not a healthy market. 17% isn't healthy, but 17 basis points isn't healthy. We are now getting back to a point from an economic standpoint where we have an inflationary environment that is above the bare minimums, 1.5%, 2%, 2.25%. In that environment, we need short-term yields that are above that, and we are getting to that end result. As such, your cash is now a valuable investment that no longer is just there earning your earning safety and you know a minimal return. It is now not only earning safety,
right,
but also earning a viable return above where the inflationary rate is. We're getting there. We're not there yet. But certainly above, you know, sort of the zero bound where we have been locked for a very long period of time.
And the heritage of this, folks, with the Federated Funds basically is a generalization. They invented the money market fund. There's some that would quibble with that. But they've been doing this in owning the high ground on short-term paper for years. Deborah Cunningham, talk to Lagarde and the ECB as John and I were talking about. Should we fear these initial rate rises from any major central bank?
Well, I do think the ECB, as was mentioned before, has some unique issues going on with it. Certainly Brexit complicated and, you know, was a factor that led into some of the shortcomings of both the UK economy as well as the European economy in broad terms. So I think that's a factor that still has to be dealt with in a way that we are not subjected to here in the United States. Having said that, when you look at those economies, yes, they're not as vibrant, they're not as fulsome, and certainly from a labor market perspective, they don't have the same you know, numbers that we have along those lines, the same strengths that we have. And as such, there are more challenges. And yet, they should not be in a negative interest rate environment. They should be at a point where there is cash, you know, there are cash earnings there as well. The economies, for the most part, are not in any kind of danger of going into a recession.
Yeah.
Not a large growth environment. But when you're looking at, you know, sort of steady and sure, you may see some setbacks as you go from, you know, -5 to 0 to +5 to 1. But that's part of what needs to happen in order to get out of the, I think part of the malaise that they have been in addition to Brexit, has been the negative rate environment, where there has not been healthy fixed income alternatives.
Deborah, just real quick here, I'm wondering whether you're actually seeing investors respond to this idea that cash is not trash, that it's a viable asset class in its own right with real yield. Is that something that you're seeing create a shift away from riskier assets back into cash for the asset value?
Yes, it's out of riskier assets, absolutely. It's also out of bank deposit assets because those don't follow the natural market rates. They're an administered rate, and so they remain in that zero bound for the most part, for most banks who don't want deposits. And it's certainly something that I think is a welcome alternative for investors that don't want to take on a lot of risk, want to maintain a lot of liquidity, keep their powder dry, yet still earn a return in the process of keeping their cash invested.
Deborah, looking forward to your appearance in Vienna. Thanks for being with us. Deborah Cunningham there at Federated Hermes.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.